Inspired Mentor, four solution-focused therapists born in four different decades who openly and honestly discuss their perspectives on the issues surrounding men's mental health, the things that stigma says we don't talk about. And we're back with another episode of Inspired Men's Talk, and we're really excited today because we've got a really nice guest on, and his name is James Wand. He's the author of the book Autism and ADHD, A Father's Perspective. And I think you can all agree that that really speaks a lot to what we do with Inspired Men Talk. So, James, why don't you introduce yourself and let us know what you're about?
Yeah, hi, I'm James. Basically, I've been a plumber for 22 years now. I've seen a lot in the trade. I'm a father of three children, two diagnosed as neurodivergent, and one we're 100% definitely going the same way as well. Over the years, looking back in hindsight, I have had a lot of mental health issues during the process. I don't think I actually realized it at the time because you just get on with it. You just kind of roll your sleeves up, get on with life. But I think looking back, and I've gone through a whole journey, especially over the last year or so, where I've realized I have been struggling a lot and I've never really found a way to get through it, how to get out of it. And it wasn't until I took my daughter to meet the lovely Nicole, who just worked wonders at the time when we needed it the most. And that opened the door for me to go and see Nicole also. And she just taught me tricks that I could use and going forward. And she just opened my eyes really to what I need to do. And it wasn't until I hit a really low point in my life last June with this process that we've been going through with my children, I kind of hit a place where I didn't like it, and I didn't realize until I was there how bad it was. I knew then I needed to take drastic action. I needed to do something for myself, for my family, for my friends, because I was becoming somebody who I didn't like anymore. And I wasn't in a strong enough place to be the father and to be the man I wanted to be for my family. And I hated it, absolutely hated it. So that's when I kind of writing all my thoughts down on my notes on my phone, just to try and process what I was thinking, what I was feeling. Because I'd hit a point in my life where I felt like a failure. I felt like I was weak. I'd become this person who my kids needed me to be the strong one, to be there, to provide. But I was slipping further and further down this hole. But there didn't seem anybody to grab me. And I just felt like, where the hell am I going with this? And it wasn't until I was on a journey home one night from work, and I was listening to the podcast about banter, and it was the same thing that day. It was just banter from my customers about being on the phone, taking too long on my lunch break. They were trying to have a laugh, and this is how they communicated with people. And normally on a good day, I can banter back, but I found myself when I was in such a dark hole. This banter, it pushed me too far. And it wasn't until I was on the drive home and I saw this HGV lorry come in, and my mind, I was gone. It got me, it pulled me aside, and everybody and everything around me was telling me in that moment, you're a failure. This is your fault. And for a split second, I thought I could do this. I could really go there. But I didn't. And I went home, had a lovely cuddle with my son. He told me he loved me, which was amazing. It really changed my perspective, but also gave me a real, say in the book, a real big punch of guilt. But it's what I needed. And it's what I needed as a dad to say I was needed and I was strong. And it wasn't until I started writing my book that's become my outlet. And I've always struggled to find that outlet. But once I started writing the words down, it all started to make sense why I was feeling it. And it's not until you start to look at the overall journey of where you started and where you end up, you then realize that it's been a cumulative right. Over the years. And it's got me to a point where I've had to make change. And fortunately for me and my family, I've reached it and I'm acting on it. So... That's pretty much me.
That's brilliant. I've got about 50 questions, but I'm not going to ask them all. because I get in trouble for hogging the microphone. But I've got one question. You've mentioned your family, you've mentioned your children and that, but you're a married man as well, aren't you? You're not a single dad.
No, I'm a married, happily married man. I've been married now for 18 years.
Yeah. And how's that? So when you talk your family, it's that whole family network what is affected by how you're feeling.
Yeah, massively. Because my wife, bless her, she's incredible. And if it wasn't for my wife, I don't know where I'd be in my own headspace. Because she's put up with me going home, and she often says when I go home, I'm there in body, but my mind's in a different place.
Yeah.
And she said, it's fair enough you being here, but allow yourself to be here. But when you're in that moment, you can't relax. Your head, your thoughts are racing, and if it wasn't for her standing by me and reminding me that I'm a good dad and a good person, I don't know where would it be. Definitely.
There's loads of other heads nodding. There's five of us on here and everybody's like, you can see the eagerness. So I'm going to let other people talk.
I mean, I think it's fair to say that you're talking from a point of view where I think we've all been there in some way. With all, and what I would take quite a lot from what you were saying, James, is you take a lot of responsibility as the man of the house, if you like, for lack of a better phrase. You take a lot of burden on yourself, you know, and I think we're all guilty of that. You know, I certainly am still and have been. You know, you feel that need to be the strong, be the strength and be the provider and all of those things. One interesting thing you said, when you felt like you were slipping down that hole, you felt like there was nobody to grab you. You didn't say, I felt like I couldn't get out. So you recognized that you needed help. You needed somebody else there. And I thought that was really, really interesting. You talk really fondly of your wife and your children. So, you know, I can see your motivation coming through really strongly.
Yeah, no, I am. And I am very much that traditional man in the respect that I was brought up there. You go out and you do your job and you have the tough upper lip. Now, I was brought up to be very, very respectful, very strict, and which I'm pleased for because it's made me who I am. But I also was brought up to just get on with it. And you definitely, it wasn't until I went on these parenting courses through trying to support my family and support my children with their issues that are going on. And I didn't want to do them initially, but what it did was it made me realize that I could either follow the parenting route that I was brought up with, or I could go against that to a certain extent to try and be more supportive and more better. Because you didn't really, growing up, you don't really talk about mental health. You didn't talk about how you're feeling this idea, because just get on with it. You know, you're the bloke, just get on with it. So that's the way I've always lived. And obviously being in being a plumber and in the building trade, even more so, you don't talk weakness, because the moment you talk weakness, they're on you like vultures, and you can never get away with it. Because once you're in the trade, and I mean, because I'm from Spalding, it's a small town, everybody seems to know everybody. So you say one thing in the building merchants or on site, you go to the next site and it's there. So you just don't say anything because it's easier that way. You're quiet and you're out of the loop.
Do you think that's true? Or do you think that's something we put on ourselves? Do you think we anticipate that without proof? Do you think there's, I mean, I agree. I think there is an element of truth there, but do you think that is absolutely true. That I used to be in trades as well. I used to be a landscaper. So I know what you're saying, but do you think that that is fact, that they won't be able to let that go? If you're seen as weak, that's it. Your reputation's ruined. Do you think that's true?
I don't know if I believe it's 100% true. No, but I think with my mindset and the way I am, and such an overthinker, that my mind takes me there.
Mm-hmm.
So I end up in this place where I think everyone's going to just get at me. But it's funny that even now I can go into a merchant's now. I could go up today when we finish this podcast and walk in, and I'll be the only man openly talking about, I've just filmed a podcast, I'm talking about mental health, everybody else just looks nervous. And yeah. and then everyone's, they don't know what to say to me. And they're just like, oh, that's nice, Jim. And, oh, you just want to man up, pull your sleeves up and get on with it. Because that's the only way they can react to what I'm saying.
Yeah, yeah.
And I am literally the only one in now in these merchants. I don't hear anybody else talking mental health. And if they do, they're taking the mick or having a little jive. And like talking to Gary last week, that it is, I can now tell the people that find it the hardest to talk mental health.
Yeah.
Because they'll just have a quick jive at you or a quick dig to try and get onto another subject quick. And it's funny now how you start to perceive men. And you can read people a little bit easier. It's funny.
Yeah, absolutely.
James, you talk about, you know, being the man, being the pillar of strength for your family. And then you mentioned about how actually being open and honest with your emotions has been a huge benefit for your children. What difference have you seen in that in your family environment now you've started talking about and displaying your emotions with them?
I think what I've seen is with our eldest, Mia, she's 13. Obviously, we were still in the learning stage, and any new parent, obviously, with your first child, it's all learning. It's all new. We make massive mistakes. We learn by them. But I've got a very close relationship with my son, George, through learning. And what I'm finding is that he's more open to me now. And I think because he's seen me at my low points and he's seen me openly talk about my mental health, he can now open up and say, like I mentioned in the book, he turned around one night and he just said, well, I know why you feel like that, Dad, because our needs are now your needs. And he's starting to realise that there's an overall thing here that we all share the burden within the house. But whilst I was trying to keep it pressed down low and be the man and put up this barrier, they weren't benefiting. They weren't opening up to me because they were trying to be me as their role model, the big, strong man. And that George said to me not long ago, he said, but you never cry, Dad. I said, mate, I really do. I said, yeah. But you just don't see it because you don't see me in my van when I get home from work and I just sit and cry in the van. You don't see that bit, mate, because I try to come in all upbeat knowing that you've had a tough day. So,
I mean, that's quite profound, isn't it? Our needs are your needs coming from your own child.
That's massive. A nine-year-old as well. It was massive. I sat there and I thought, where did that come from? But I love it because I know he's so in touch with his emotions, George is. Like, I mean, he can go and listen to a song and he'll start crying because he'll listen to the lyrics. And I like that because I know he's going to grow up talking emotion. He's growing up in a better way than I probably did in connecting with it. So it's good. I really like it.
In the book, James, you talk about this Coke bottle effect for how it was with Mia and her emotions. And I think it's a really lovely analogy. Yeah. I was wondering if, for anyone that hasn't yet read the book, would you explain, A, what it is, and B, where you got it, where you found that kind of analogy from? Because I think it's a really nice one.
Yeah, well, the Coke bottle effect, it's quite a common analogy in parents for neurodivergent children, and it's on all the Facebook forums and all them kinds of stuff, and you get taught it when you get early help involved through schools and stuff. But basically, the Coke bottle effect was described as if you imagine a child or any human being now, because I know I have the Coke bottle effect, so I and this is the thing, through learning stuff to teach my children, all I've done is taught myself, and yeah. It's quite, I wouldn't have reached this point if I hadn't had to teach my children, so it's been quite an eye-opener. But the Coke bottle effect is you have a fresh bottle of Coke or any fizzy drink, and you, every time you encounter some level of stress throughout the day, whether you've lost your keys or the job doesn't turn up, or you go out and someone cuts you up in a car, or every time you encounter stress, you shake your bottle. And of course, all of us throughout the day, we keep the lid on because you don't want to show people how stressed you are. So you, like my children, and I've learned that they mask, and I think we all mask to a certain level, and we go through day with this mask on, pretending to be someone that we're not, just to get through the day. And then every time you encounter it, you keep shaking. And then when you walk through your front door and you're in your safe space, your home, if you try taking that lid off and imagine the explosion, that's what we were witnessing every day with our children through being in a school environment. So,
and when you think about it now for yourself, if there's anyone else kind of going through that in their lives, do you have any tips for releasing that bottle before you get home?
Yeah, well, it's funny because I was talking to Nicole on Saturday, and we both share the same thought process. I'm a lot happier when I've been working a good 20 minutes from home, because I can crank my music up and I can sing and I can scream and I can just let it all out. And for me, music is a massive release. Now, I love music, and I love singing in the van, and being a tradesman and driving on my own van, it's a win-win. I just love it. And if anyone can see me at traffic lights, God knows what I look like.
So, okay. Yeah. Just from a personal perspective, what's your go-to song? Mine was always Angels, but what's your go-to song?
Oh, yeah. See, that was always my karaoke classic, Angels. I love belting out Guns N' Roses.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, I love getting that on because it's just got a beat that carries. It's an uplift. Angels in the early days was, but I find slow songs now too moving, and I need upbeat. I need something to really heavy, and Guns N' Roses is heavy enough.
Yeah, as you get older, you'll move on to AC/DC.
Oh, now yeah, that started slipping in. That's yeah, definitely.
I also read, since we've got a thing, a gap, I'll jump in. I also really liked the whole thing about the spoons and replenishing the spoons. And you were, when you talked about that with Mia, and we have a thing of, like, we call it scaling, and we do the 1 to 10, but you know, the spoons was a really nice analogy, and it kind of stuck with me as well.
Yeah.
How would you help her to replenish the spoons, and how do you replenish your spoons?
Well, with the kids, we were just very child led. So we sat down one day and said, you know, let's think of it as spoons. And we learned this on a course called the Early Bird course, and it was run by the National Autistic Society. And we just sat down one day, and it was child-led, and we just said, look, you tell us with this analogy. And she loved it. She jumped on it. And it was the first thing that really worked with explaining emotions, because the kids really struggle to what they're thinking. And it did work. And she soon learned that, you know, technology is a big thing for the kids, having that time to go off on the technology or the Barbies or their reading. And then we even brought her a little spoon for when she used to go to school. A family friend brought her a little silver spoon so she could tie it to a bag, just so when she was at school, she needed the spoon, she touched the spoon, and it gave her that home feeling, home connection. But they're starting to learn now that they can just take themselves away for that 5 minutes, 10 minutes away from the family and friends and replenish. I found myself last night, so I suppose, filling my spoons, and I'd had such a bad day, and because I had so much work to do, and I'm not going to lie, I was getting worked up about today. It's completely new for me. I'm ever so nervous, got a nervous tummy, but we had family over, and all I needed to do was my quotes. My work, I needed to get my work done, but people were in and out of my house. Then the dog started barking, and I ended up on the couch with my head hood up over my head screaming because I'd reached my limit.
Your Coke bottle was full and filled.
Yeah, massively. But what I hadn't done was done my own learning and released it throughout the day. I'd kept push, and last night I lost it with George, and I just said, I need 5 minutes. And I always tell him I need 5 minutes, because he needs to know that I'm taking myself away, because I need that respite. Yeah. 5 minutes on the guitar, playing a few chords, went back in. I was a different bloke because I'd given myself that step away. And I've struggled to remember, but I always need to just take that step to one side, to take myself away from that head-on collision. And then I go back a different person every time.
I think that's... I'm sorry.
Go on.
I think it's really interesting that you talk about talking with George. You sort of lost it with George a little bit, but you know you needed 5 minutes. You recognise that, and I know, as a father of young kids myself, the guilt that comes with when you're stressed and you, again, for lack of a better phrase, you take it out on the kids a little bit, or you lose your temper with the kids. The guilt that comes with that is unbearable. It's awful, you know, and I've been guilty of this plenty of times, where you really torture yourself over that. So I think it's really, really good that you've kind of recognized and you've got this communication with your kids that you can say, I need 5 minutes, take yourself away, do what you need to do, and then come back into the situation. Yeah. I think a lot of people can learn that they shouldn't be guilty for that. You know, that's perfectly like the right thing to do in that moment. I mean, yeah. You must have suffered from that yourself, where you feel so guilty just for the way you've reacted to something they've done.
I'll openly admit it. Most days I carry guilt.
Yeah.
Because running a business, granted, I've taken my foot off the pedal a lot in the last 12 months, but running a business and being the father of three and having a wife, I do lose my cool quite quick. I'm quite a hot-headed person, and the amount of times I've driven to work feeling so filled with guilt from the way that I've mishandled a situation, how I've snapped. But I always go back that night and I'll always say, I'm sorry. I'm sorry for the way I behaved. It was wrong. I should have done this. I should have done that. And I try to teach them. But they also need to know that you can make mistakes. It's just how you rectify it. It's how you talk to them afterwards and how to put things right. So
is that quite a fine line? Because I'm sitting here listening and going, but people who are saying sorry should learn from them so they don't have to do it again. But it's a very difficult space because you keep getting, you know, pressure and stress build up on you. You lose your temper a little bit and are nasty or narky or just shut down, whatever your thing is, and then you apologize for it, but then you do the same. So are you saying right now that you're actually going, okay, I know what I did, how can I not do that in the future? Is that some part of what you're doing now?
Because
saying sorry is only part of the fix, isn't it?
I'm always trying to. I'm always self-analyzing myself. Mm. And yeah, every time I say sorry, I'm always thinking about how can I be better, and how can I approach that situation different next time.
So it's not just a fob off of apologize, get over it, move on, which people who aren't learning use don't they?
Yeah, well, I'm always wanting to be a better dad.
Mm.
And I'm desperate for all three of my kids to grow up more open than I ever have been. And we've been taught on these courses that the only way you can teach them is by role modeling it. You can't just tell them it.
It's interesting. We had a guest on when we first started doing this, and it was a guest who runs a charity called Lads Needs Dads. So it's for children who don't have dads. And it's why they don't necessarily grow up as well, because there's a difference in their opinion between a mother and a father. And she, one of the things she, because I've always thought role modeling is so important. And she said it's not the role modeling, it's the mentoring. It's not you going, oh, do this. It's like showing them stuff, teaching them stuff, explaining why those things are happening.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm hearing you do. You're using the term role modeling the same as I would, but actually there's so much more to just be like me, because we can role model people but not know much about them. We don't learn from them. We just be like them. You're teaching your children as well. And teaching, one of the things I wanted to ask you, because you said when you go into the builders merchants, you're the only one who talks about mental health. People give banter, people ignore it. The construction industry has the highest suicide rate of all industries. So using that analogy of Coke bottle, they might be bantering, they might not be talking about it, but they're fizzing away until they pop, mm-hmm. and then they do something drastic because they've not had those releases, which you're now massively open to, looking for continual releases. How would you, change it? You know, is there anything you can see in an industry point of view where that can be put a dent in it, at least?
I honestly don't know. I don't know what the answer is. All I know is just so everyone's trying to be better than everybody else on a day-to-day basis. And
so it's competitive.
Everyone's competitive. I know, looking back over the years when I've been on site, like, I've always considered myself quite a decent plumber. I'm not the best of plumbers, but I'm a decent plumber. I'm conscientious about my work. I like it to be right. But because I put that into my trade on site, they're everyone pick your weakness and then go on it and tell you, oh yeah, that's rubbish. Yeah, if I wouldn't be doing it like this. But looking back now, the people that were saying this to me are still in the same job. They're still doing the same thing. And I look at them as different people now and think, actually, I think you were struggling more than I was at the time. But because I had it quite together, that's what they put in there.
So they were projecting their vulnerability onto you.
Oh, I think so. So now. And I wouldn't have seen that at the time. At the time, I was going home. And when I used to work for somebody, I remember I hit... I'd say I was depressed, and I was coming home from work depressed because it's relentless every day, the banter that you get. And when you're not in the right headspace, it's not banter. It starts taking an effect, and you start focusing on what people have said to you throughout the day, throughout the week, and it layers up. And the problem is, once it starts layering up, you're trapped. And it wasn't until my wife just said, "You just need to get out and do something about it, or change what's happening." And that's when I went and got. That's when I became a lecturer at Boston College for 4 days.
Four days.
Yeah, honestly, because I needed out. I was desperate. I was going home every day, so depressed. And my wife got. I saw this advertisement for a college lecturer, and she said, "Just do it." I said, "No, I can't be a lecturer." So I did it. And they said it was one of the best interviews that I'd had for a long time.
Excellent.
And I was like, "Oh, this is amazing." Got the job, stood in front of this class, and I was like, "This isn't me." What the hell have I just, what have I done? But that was desperation to get out of an environment that was killing me. It was awful. But the problem is, looking back now, what had happened was I'd lost my granddad, and my relationship with my granddad was so close. And I still, I lost him 2013, and I still think about him every day. I miss him a bit.
Yeah.
Now, he was my role model. He was my guy. So I lost him, and then everything at work was compounding, and I never really spoke about the loss of my granddad. And looking, it's only now through this whole writing journey and addressing who I am, I can look back and say, we had George in the 2014, I lost my granddad in the year before. That time of my life, looking back, I think I was in quite a dark time, and I didn't realise. But most of it was through grief, through losing my granddad. And then the jibes at work and all this kind of stuff, and people not pulling the weight. We were then entering a process of not understanding what was going on with our daughter. My mind was so full, and then I lashed out at everybody at work one day. And these were guys that I've known for years, since I was a teenager, and they were quite good mates. And I lost it and told them what I thought about them, and told them about how childish they were, that they needed to grow up, they needed to, and they all kind of went, "Whoa, Jim, hang on a minute, why are you being so horrible?" But I'd reached my limit. And they were in the firing line, and they didn't deserve it, but I wasn't addressing my mental health, and they took the brunt of it.
Ben, you're nodding loads, and Ben comes from a completely different spectrum, but similar by the sounds of it.
One thing that struck me, James, is the gaslighting section in your book, and about how hard your journey has been to get answers, to get solutions. Both trying to find those answers online in those groups yourself, but equally being dismissed by professionals or hinted at that you are the problem, you are the cause of all your issues, and that your parenting style is to blame, or you're not being willing to adjust and change. And that, to me, just sounds a horrific minefield. And there's going to be parents out there who are just beginning that journey, like you did. What would you say, if you could give them any piece of advice to cope with that and to keep their determination alive, to keep pushing forward,
Is there anything you could recommend or suggest that you found worked for you?
Number one is trust you're a good parent, and don't be fobbed off, and reach out for the people that are living this journey. We left it too late. We were in the mindset of, oh, we just need to change. We need to be better. We need to do this. We need to do that. And we were fighting to keep in touch with parents of the neurotypical people and the lifestyle that we've been brought up with. And it wasn't until we accepted, I think, who we were as individuals and as a family, and said, hey, do you know what? It's all right to be different. Yeah, why are we fighting to keep in with a niche of people that don't understand it and are never going to understand it, and they're never going to listen? And there's such a big feeling that comes along with validation. And when you're validated and your thoughts are validated about what you're doing, it's massive. But now I trust myself as a dad, and Emily trusts herself as a mum. And when the professionals dismiss you, these are professionals that you go to for the support, and you don't get it.
Mm.
And it once or twice you can kind of go, oh, it's not an issue, but it's continuous. It's week in, it's week out, it's meeting after meeting. And these are professionals that I used to look up to with respect, that they knew better than me. Whereas now they don't. And I think I'm now confident enough to say that I know my child better than anybody else on this planet.
Absolutely.
And it's trust your gut and follow your gut and don't be dismissed.
I think that's quite a big message for a lot of people. You know, I think every single parent on the planet has doubted themselves many, many times. So I think that's a really important message. One thing I did want to ask is, you said about distancing yourself from those people who are just never going to get it, never going to understand, always going to question what you're doing. How did you find that with extended family? You know, because I know that there's a lot of people in the position you're in that it's a continuous battle with people that are close to them, as well as just friends and family. You know, the extended family quite often are in that category as well, where they just won't get it. Did you find that a struggle?
So personally, I think for myself and my wife, that was the bit that hurt the most, because friends and distant family, you can kind of understand it. But I think you feel that your family, your immediate family, should always have your back, and they should always trust you and trust your judgment. But the problem we had was no one else in our family or anybody we knew had been diagnosed with any kind of neurodiversity. So we didn't know anybody with autism or ADHD or anything. So we were the first ones. And fortunately, Emily, being a teacher, she had the experience. So we were looking at different here. We're looking at different. And it took me, and that I mentioned in the book, it took me a long time to accept as a dad, my kids are different. And
can I just stop there? Being a dad, and
as
you can see, I'm one of the oldest one in the room. So that means there's something wrong with me, or there's something wrong with how I produce children. Was that part of it? You know, I go back and, we go back and, if I had a gay child, what's wrong with me that my child is gay, my child is deformed? In old-fashioned money, it was, I'm weak because I produced a child who's not fit for purpose. And I know that's not true now, and it's certainly not where I come from now, but my generation and older, that's how we looked at things. Was that ever there for you? That part of coming to terms with it?
And I think the problem is, like, we had close family say to us, well, you just need to do this, you need to be tougher. And I think then it was being told, but insinuating that we needed to be the better parents. So I don't think I ever had the thought of saying that it was my fault. It was just that I was doing things wrong. And then when that's backed up by the professionals and the mental health professionals that are meant to be giving you the advice to help you, all they're really doing is just reinforcing everybody else's message that you're parenting wrong. And then you start questioning, well, actually, is it neurodiversity, or is it our fault? And every night becomes self-analysis, and me and Emily talking about what we've done and what we could have changed, how we could be better, constant. But it is a self-doubt. And as a dad, you perceive your children to fit into a certain role and to go to the clubs and to have lots of friends and to love going to busy places and to discos and to cinemas. And in the early days, I thought I'd accepted it, but it's literally only this last 12 months I'm writing the book that I can now look back and say, it's absolutely fine to be who you are. And we've just accepted our new life. And I think our mental health through acceptance has improved.
Yeah. I just want to tickle a little bit more on the sort of battles you had to face with other people. I mean, do you find that everybody's always an expert as well? Whenever, you know, not the experts, but the people that you, you know, you talk to, everybody, the builder's merchant you might talk to, everybody in your friend and family group.
Well, everyone, yeah.
Everybody knows better.
Everyone that's older than you and who's got kids and who's been through this journey, they know better than you. And that includes my family. I've told them myself. It includes our siblings, our parents. And I mentioned in the book, it wasn't until we actually moved in with my father-in-law and my sister-in-law when we had some building work done. And it wasn't until you actually see behind closed doors about the effects that a day can have on people, and you can see them in their raw state. They didn't see it. But you do that, like when you go to the professionals at school, like that's a different chapter on its own. When you're dealing with these professionals that, again, like I say, you looked up to at the beginning, and when they were telling us to force our child into school, that there's nothing wrong, and you just go, yeah, sorry, yeah, that, yeah, and you keep forcing them and forcing them and forcing them. And like with Mia, it wasn't until she had the burnout that you realised that actually we'd been following the professional's advice, but all it did was cause such ill health mentally for our daughter, and I don't think she's ever really truly recovered from it.
It's really funny, and I know I'm keep jumping in here, but in old-fashioned money, like I'm a therapist. I work with Nicole, who you've worked with. We work exactly the same. All of us are. So this isn't our opinion. But going back decades to when I was a young man, and a 13-year-old can't have burnout. It's like, don't tell them to get up and do it.
Yeah.
So just recognizing that your daughter had enough, that's so different to what probably the way I was brought up, certainly, because a 13-year-old can't. They're just being difficult.
Mm-hmm.
So that's huge.
Yeah, and a lot of people told us at the time, oh, she's just acting out. She's just trying to get away with it. And these were quite close people to us. They're just saying, are you sure she's not just trying to pull the wool over your eyes? And it's not until you've witnessed it firsthand in this mental health in your child that they're lost. And they're lost, and you can actually see through them. And they just vanish from you, and it's a very, very hard place to be. But that came from following the professional's advice and not trusting your own experience, and it just pushed her further and further away. So it's a dark place to be, but it's a lesson that we've now learned that with our older children, as soon as a professional says, well, we think you should be doing this, we straight out going, no, we're not.
Thinking about your own mental health, James, because that's obviously the other side of this journey, is you went for therapy. How difficult was it to reaching that decision to try therapy? And I know you talked about CBT wasn't what you needed. What was the difference between the therapy options that were available? And obviously hypnotherapy was one that worked for you. Why did it work?
It worked because I had seen what it had done to Mia, and I'd met Nicole. And I think it helped me personally because I already had a connection with Nicole and there was a trust there. I've never been that kind of person to pick up a phone and go, help. You just don't do it. But I feel grateful because I was there at the beginning with Mia, and I got to meet Nicole, and I got to meet how Nicole did her job. And I just liked it. I felt at ease and I felt comfortable. And like talking to her on Saturday, I like the fact that you don't dwell on what's happened. And I just like the simplicity of how she dealt with me. And I felt very, very comfortable in her presence. And I don't know, I just felt easy doing it. And it took, don't get me wrong, I still slip out of it. But I still, I've listened to the audio nearly every single night since I started writing the book. So this is the thing, I let what I'd learned slowly fade away.
Yeah.
And it's not until I start hitting a low point again and struggling, I think, oh, I've got to start writing a positive book. And I start writing my book and start listening to the audio again. And it's now got to the point where start falling asleep. Emily goes, you ain't got your audio on. So I have to quickly get my phone because I now need to know, I have to have the audio. I have to have it to go to sleep. So my children still need it as well. No, it was a good thing meeting Nicole. I really like Nicole. Yeah, and she helps us a lot, bless her.
That's fantastic. So we are coming up to about 40 minutes. So, I mean, we could keep talking to you for ages, I'm sure. One thing I kind of want to step a little bit backwards. Talking again about those builders and merchants that you go into, and you're the only one standing there talking about mental health. And I think Gary asked you a question of, well, how can we make a dent in that atmosphere? I think you're doing that. I think you're already doing that. Yes, they might give you a few digs and they might go a bit sheepish when you start talking about your experiences. But a couple of them might be sitting there quite quietly going, this guy can talk about it. This guy, you know, it might not happen in that moment, but they might go away and that will play on them and they'll process through. And that might make that little bit of difference. And they might just go, they might not talk to you about it, or they might not talk to their mates about it, but they might go home and talk to their partners or their family because they've seen you setting that example, just like you set your example for your children fantastically. I think you're setting an example for all those other tradies. And yeah. I think you should be proud of that.
Yeah, and I am. And one massive, profound thing that's happening, since I have started talking about it, I've had three or four men say to me one-on-one, I've been through a tough time, and that's the thing. No one's ever opened up to me. No one in the 22 years I've been working on site and in people's houses, no one's ever spoke. But for the last, especially 2-3 years since we've been hitting a real low, I've become more open, and I speak to all of my customers. I think they're sick to death of my story now because I just tell everybody everywhere I go, plumbing merchants, customers, friends, everything. I'm always talking about my kids and my own mental health. And that if I'm having a bad day, I don't go in there and if they go, you're all right, I don't go, yep. I go, no, actually, do you know what? I've had a really crap day. And sometimes they look open to it, but I had a tradie who I work with quite regularly. He opened up to me because I started telling him about my plan to write the book to help other parents and I'd sort my own mental health out. And he, out of nowhere, now he's Jack the Lad. Everybody loves him. The customers love him. He's always quick, quirky. He's such a lovely bloke. But this one day, he sat with me outside my van and he just opened up. And I'm not going to, for 1 minute, delve into what he said, but
of course not.
It was hard. It was hard to listen. And I was just like, Christ, mate, where did that come from? And he said, I trust you because you opened up.
Yeah. And I think that is the biggest issue, because I where I'm sitting now was constructed, and everybody, the guy who came into the blinds, the guy who did the plastering, the guy who put the stud balls up, every single one of them told me, when they said, oh, what are you doing here? Oh, it's a mental health center. Boosh, it will come out. And you know they never spoke to anyone else. So as soon as they know you're on their team, as it were, men talk. It's just that we're so terrified that you're going to use it against them as a tradesman, so you don't. But as soon as you realise that one's safe, I think there's loads of stuff going on and they're just scared to share.
Yeah, and I was scared. I was scared. But I think now I'm growing that outside skin to say, actually, do you know what? There isn't anything to be scared of because it's a damn sight worse to keep it bottled up. Because I've even had a customer, like just randomly, I was just talking to him about my kid and what we've been through. And again, he'd been in a very, very dark place, but he opened up to me. And I just said, I can't really believe you're telling me this. I'm only doing fixing your taps. He said, I just like you. He said, and he said, you've just told me, you've just put your heart on your sleeve. You told me what's going on in your head. I feel like I can relate to you. And that's the thing. What I've found is when you find someone you can relate to, and you can just take that 5 minutes to stop your brain from wearing and just open up, everybody starts opening up back to you.
Then I asked you why that therapy worked for you, because you've tried different things. You've been to parenting sessions, you've tried CBT, and then you started working with Nicole. And Nicole's a solution-focused hypnotherapist.
Yeah.
All of us do the same. We've all trained together, same as Nicole. And do you think the fact that when we're particularly dealing with people in the trades or men in particular, that us never needing to understand the past, they're never going to get you to tell us your story in detail, so you don't have to feel vulnerable, helps you move forward so you can look at what's coming up rather than drag along your history?
Yeah, 100%. Because what Nicole did with me, which I loved, is she got me to sign an unwritten contract with her every week I went to see her, and she tricked me into watching the rugby. And I'd go home, I'll go, I've been tricked. And Emily will say, what do you mean? I'll say, she's bloody done it again. I've got to sit down at 4:45 with my pint and I've got to be ready for the rugby. She's like, well, why? I said, because that's what Nicole said. And if I don't do it, she's going to ask me if I did it.
So let me just ask you a question. Did Nicole say that, or did you tell Nicole that's what you was going to do?
I told Nicole, but somehow she got me doing things that... She was putting me first, and I think that's the difference. I've been putting my children first.
Everybody's laughing because that's what we do, and it's nothing special. But we get you to come up. You're the expert on you.
Yeah, well,
the expert on your children, but we just have to ask the right questions so you tell us your expertise about you watching the rugby.
Yeah. So because the thing is, I've always been a massive sport fan. I always used to watch football religiously. It had to be live. Couldn't watch it recorded. But obviously, your kids come into your life.
Mm.
They take priority. So our whole life was revolved around giving our kids the best life we could possibly give them. But obviously, in doing that, you just neglect yourself straight away. But I was finding myself, like when I did watch that rugby match, and I go back and speak to Nicole, she said, are you okay? And I thought, you know, I had a really nice weekend.
Yeah.
And then it's the happy hormones were kicking in, and We now find ourselves saying to friends that whilst these forums on Facebook, these Facebook forums with parents, they're great to have a community. But when you're in that depressed state, it's one of the worst places to be.
Because everybody's loading with problems.
Yeah, and you're just feeding yourself. So when you've had a bad day and then you sit there and you start scrolling, you're just feeding yourself negativity constant.
So I've got a last question for you, which is very controversial. Very controversial. And then I know Christopher wants to wrap it up by asking all the normal stuff. I get people who are speaking to me all the time, those people, those external people, and they go, ADHD, it's just a fashion now. Everybody's ADHD. Everybody's looking for a diagnosis. How does that fit with you? That everybody is ADHD or looking... We're using it.
I believe we're all got a different neurotypical brains. Definitely, we're all individuals. But with my children, I can see when you compare to other children, they do need that additional support. And the problem is, everyone goes, "Oh, you just want the label." Well, sometimes you do, because in this day and age, just saying that your child needs support or you need support isn't enough. And until when you actually learn so much about a subject such as autism or ADHD, because you've had to, there's so much need there that's under the radar that you can't physically see. And unless you understand what it is and have the diagnosis and know what you're researching, how can you ever begin to know what support they need? And it's only through our own learning that our children need so much more support than that's on the surface, and people just don't understand it. And Nicole said in our meetings that she said to me something about ADHD, and I said it. She went, "You think?" And friends of mine have also said ADHD, because my brain is 100 miles an hour. It can, doing this podcast, I've got so many different thoughts coming in about jobs and work and stuff. I can't
do you need a label, or going for a label, would that just be you? Oh, see, I'm now one of the ADHD clan, and I can go, oh, sorry, I couldn't come into work today because I had ADHD was worse today. So that's what people are saying. It's a new bad back.
I think, to be honest, I think there are some people, there are, again, controversial, there are some people that go, well, I think I'm ADHD. I think I might be autistic. And I think there is always going to be that fashion that people will jump on it because it's just something to have. But if there is a genuine need, then you should have it. You should have the label, and you should have the diagnosis, because it helps others around you understand probably why you acted the way you acted, why you're struggling that day. There's nothing, I don't know. It's, people do jump on the fashions.
Or is it people are trying to self-diagnose because they can't see a health professional and actually get the diagnosis because it's on the floor? But you can always Google signs and symptoms.
Yeah, well, yeah, exactly. And I've convinced myself I'm ADHD through Googling. But it might just be the fact of my lifestyle and the fact that I've got so much going on. That's why my brain never switches off, because I don't give myself that time to stop and to focus. So I don't know. It is a controversial one, really. I don't know the exact answer, but I know without a diagnosis from my children's perspective, they can't get support.
Yeah, well, I think that's the important thing in today's systems that we have to live by, today's schooling. It's having the label is not something to be ashamed of. Without that recognition, the support just isn't there, unfortunately. And I wish we were in a situation where it didn't matter what the label was, everybody got the support that individual needed. Because like you said, every neurotypical person has just as many different needs as every neurodiverse person, you know.
Yeah.
We all have our own needs. But like you say, the people with neurodivergence, they do need that extra bit of support. And without that recognition, that label, if that's what you want to call it, that's not open to them. So it is just the way things are now, and I think we have to recognize that, you know.
Yeah. So quickly, I listened to a podcast not long ago when I was trying to sort out my own headspace and writing the book and stuff, and there was an autistic guy on there, and he said in schools, it, in his opinion, would be much better if we didn't have autism or ADHD, because everyone's an expert on them. Everyone's a self-confessed expert that they know best. If you went to a teacher and said, my child is neurodivergent, they'd have to look into them as an individual, not as a label.
Yeah.
And I kind of listened to it, and I thought, God, he's right. Because I know for a fact that every single teacher and professional I've come across and said, we've got ADHD or autism, they know more than me because they've learned an hour of it as part of their training.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
And that they're an expert. Whereas if you go to them and say, my child's neurodivergent, they go, well, this needs looking into. And then all of a sudden they'll meet the need, not the label.
Of course.
Yeah. And I think that's quite profound.
It is. Again, I think that's a whole other podcast, though, talking about the labels and the schooling systems. But we do need to wrap up. So it has been really great talking to James. Ben, Peter, have you got anything, last things you want to say to James before we go?
Just to say thank you very much for being so open and sharing everything with us. And I hope that we weren't too hard on you and that you want to do more podcasts, because what you've got to say is really important.
That's good, because I feel like I've just waffled.
But that's the way we do it. We just waffle, because people love to hear true stories rather than systematic questioning.
Yeah, I'm grateful. I'm grateful because it's not until you experienced it yourself and you've been in a dark place. I never understood mental health until I accepted what it is.
Yeah.
And that's only through going through my own trials and tribulations. So, but it doesn't take long to get there.
Cool.
Thanks from me as well, James. It's been a really fantastic conversation, and I've already got clients that I'm going to be recommending to read your book, because they are on that journey that you and your family have experienced. So yeah,
thank you. Because again, if somebody had turned around to me 8 years ago and said, "There's this guy with a book," I needed that book.
Yeah, absolutely. On that subject, James, do you want to tell, just to finish up, do you want to tell the listeners where they can find your book for a start, where they can find any social media around you, and any links that you've got to stuff that you want people to know about?
The book's Autism and ADHD, A Father's Perspective. It is all on pre-sale now with Amazon, Waterstones, Barnes & Noble. I'm expecting it to be on ebook format any day now too. I will be setting up Instagram posts, etc., and I will get a landing page, probably linked to Facebook. I think we're going with the tag James Wand Author. That was help from Nicole as well. So there is stuff in the process, and I'm hoping to kickstart helping other people in some way. I just don't know how yet. We're just at the book stage at the moment.
Well, if you ever fancy a change of career, we need more male hypnotherapists.
Yeah.
And you seem like you'd fit the bill perfectly.
I do know what, I wouldn't mind giving it a go. Once my home life settled down a little bit, I think, when the kids are a bit happier, I'd love to. The feeling I've got from helping the other men that have now opened up to me, and that we had a couple of private messages from a newspaper article last week, and I sat in bed next to George and I started welling up, because you realize that actually, by being brave and getting your story out, people genuinely need to know they're not alone. And I did get a really feeling of pride for what I'd done just reading people's messages. I love it. I absolutely love it.
Yeah, get used to that now, because you know, we get plenty, but you're giving Nicole a lot of praise. I'm just going to say that's Hummingbird Hypnotherapy.
Yeah, Nicole. Yeah, Hummingbird. Yeah,
Hummingbird Hypnotherapy in Bourne. Just if anybody wants to locate that, again, we all do that as well. So you know, there's lots of people out there who do solution focused work. Lots of people who don't, but you've got to find your groove. The people who, like you say, who fit you, and that's really important. And you know, but you should get used to it. We get plenty and we haven't got your backstory, so that's amazing. So I'm very pleased. Thank you for coming on and sharing your stuff.
Thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to talk. I think we all need to, definitely.
I think it's just a sincere thank you, James. I mean, there's lots of people that need to hear this story, and I think it's fantastic. So thank you for coming on, and thank you for writing your book.
No, thank you very much. Thanks for helping me get the message out.
Thank you for listening to the podcast that proves men do talk.
If you would like more information or support, then please visit inspiredtochange.biz,
where you can learn more about us and the Inspired to Change team.
And remember, the conversation continues on our social media, Inspired Men Talk.